Hello, and thank you for listening to the New Polis podcast. My name is Tate Fagley, and joining me today are Jackson B. Archer and Floyd Noel. Today we wanted to talk about just trends in policing and the militarization of the police, which has been especially pronounced in a recent incident in Georgia. Floyd, could you tell us about that?
Yeah, recently there was a SWAT raid that took place outside of Atlanta, and it was covered on Salon.com. The headline was, "A SWAT team blew a hole in my 2-year-old son." And what had happened was the police conducted a no-knock raid based on some actually turned out to be faulty information that they had gotten. And so they came in at the middle of the night and conducted a raid looking for drugs, as is generally seems to be standard procedure. They used flash bangs, which are created to disorient people when a raid is conducted, where the subjects of the flashbang can't hear or see anything for at least several seconds, if not minutes. In this case, the flashbang had landed in the 2-year-old's crib and blew a hole in his chest. He ended up getting put in a medically induced coma for about 3 weeks and then was transferred to another hospital. So he's still healing, and the doctor is still assessing any kind of brain damage. But the effects on the family, you know, this actually, the statistic we were looking at earlier was that SWAT team raids happen something like over 100 times per day in the United States. And it doesn't get covered a lot of times, but this piece made it, and it was kind of emotionally, I think it was emotionally hard for a lot of people to read, you know, and for the family, definitely. One part of the story, the author wrote that her 8-year-old woke up in the middle of the night screaming, "No, don't kill him. You're hurting my brother. Don't kill him." And, you know, she was worried about the long-term effects, not just to the 2-year-old victim, but the whole family is going to have, you know, psychological problems and issues for this for a long time to come. So, you know, what I kind of wanted to talk about was, you know, the recent increased militarization of the police. Is that, what are the causes of that? And, you know, has this been something that is new, or, you know, have the police always been this way and we just never noticed? What do you guys think?
I'd say clearly it hasn't always been like this. We can point to a time in the past, not really that long ago, when policemen or peace officers were essentially members of the community and doing a job that was more or less expected of everyone in the community. It was just happened to be their full-time job. But that didn't mean that other people couldn't do the same job. And I mean, this doesn't work with a lot of the things we have, like traffic infractions and things like that. You didn't just have your average Joe writing traffic tickets, but they could, an average citizen could and did perform arrests. And in fact, in many states, including Idaho, it's still possible to perform a citizen's arrest. And people just generally looked out for each other. Of course, there was no real drug war back then. So that's another key component, I think. But as far as if it's always been this way, yeah, that's definitely a no.
Right. And like you mentioned the drug war, a lot of the militarization of the police has its roots there. Of course, it's not only the drug war, because, you know, the drug war has been with us since the 80s, whereas the militarization of police is a little bit more recent than that, but it still goes hand in hand with the drug war in that it's, well, more recently it's been the Department of Homeland Security and DEA and other, you know, federal law enforcement agencies that have been providing grants and other incentives to state and local law enforcement to ramp up their policing of the drug war. And we've seen that even in Idaho, in Boise and Nampa, and even smaller places like Preston, Idaho, receiving mine-resistant assault vehicles that were formerly used in war zones and giving them to police. Like Jackson said, no, this hasn't always been the case. And the one of the major reasons for the rise of the militarization is the drug war and the federal government providing these financial incentives for police. In addition, what also should be mentioned are the civil asset forfeiture laws, whereby property that police suspect have been used in the commission of a crime can be seized by the police and doesn't have Fifth Amendment protections of due process. It's crazy, but the legal argument goes that since it's, you know, property, it doesn't have a right to due process. So it kind of turns the traditional, like, common law rules on their head, where instead of the government having to prove that this property, whether it be a car or a house or whatever they want to seize, was used in the commission of a crime, you instead, as the property owner, have to prove that it was not guilty. So it's turning the presumption of innocence into the presumption of guilt. So that also has provided an incentive for police officers to be more arduous in their pursuit of drug offenders, because a lot of times the proceeds from these seizures will go directly back into these police departments themselves, you know, providing a really bad incentive for them to seize people's property rather than protect it.
So it seems like we have a lot of really bad incentives here, from drug war policies to federal funding to civil asset forfeiture. And it seems like another underlying, you know, bad incentive problem is the disconnect between the people who pay for the services and the people who get the service. How do you guys think that affects the police services that we get? Do any of you know, do either of you guys know the amount of funding that comes from, let's say, local sources versus federal sources these days?
Well, those exact numbers, I don't know. Do you, Tate?
Well, as far as exact numbers, funding from state and local governments will make up the majority of their budgets. However, the grants and other financial incentives provided by the feds are really too great to pass up. And this can even still lead to worse incentives, where the federal government has really inserted itself into federal law enforcement, where through these civil asset forfeiture programs, if the proceeds from these civil asset forfeitures are shared with federal agencies, these state and local law enforcement are able to bypass certain laws, certain state and local laws regarding civil asset forfeiture, because of this sharing. Then they're under federal law, which is a lot less restrictive than a lot of state and local law. So, I mean, this is really a good example of where the federal government is undermining the sovereignty of state and local governments. But as far as proportions of their budget goes, still the majority of funding is from state and local, but that doesn't mean that the federal government doesn't have a huge influence on how they decide to expend their resources.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I'd just add, to kind of touch on a theme that I do quite often, and that's to the extent that the feds are giving away goodies and money to these local agencies, of course they're exerting their own influence, and that's just more decision making that's taking place in a way that's far removed from the people it really affects. So it's a scale problem, and that's of course the thing that we talk about a lot here on the New Polis podcast. But I think it's really relevant in this case, as in so many others. Who has more pull over your police chief or your elected sheriff? Maybe is it you, a citizen, or is it somebody who can give them a lot of things they want?
I had been wondering what the difference was between, you know, in earlier times where people, we didn't really have these no-knock raids and we didn't have such problems with the police, but it seems like people viewed that more as a responsibility of the community to handle, whereas now it seems like we've kind of divorced ourselves from the responsibility and the duty of policing our neighborhoods and policing ourselves and self-defense and all those sort of things. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. The personal responsibility is a huge thing, and we see a lot of people who understand that today because of the numbers of applications for concealed carry permits and the firearms purchases. I mean, people are doing these kinds of things, I think, over concerns about self-defense, and that's good insofar as it reflects an elevated sense of, or a renewed sense perhaps, of personal responsibility. But I would just simply extend that responsibility and say it's not just you or your family. It should really extend to your community. One of the reasons I feel safe where I live is because of the neighbors I have. I mean, I live in an apartment building with 10 units, and everybody here really looks out for each other, and there's just kind of a sense and understanding between the tenants, and it's a very good thing. And for me, that contributes a lot more to my sense of safety for myself and my family than the knowing or not knowing if somebody's patrolling the area. So I would definitely agree as far as personal responsibility.
And Tate, you had an example of a police case where courts determined that the police actually don't have any obligation to protect any individual person. Is that right?
Right. This case it was from 2005. It was called Castle Rock v. Gonzalez. So the Supreme Court found that this woman named Jessica Gonzalez didn't have a constitutional right to police protection. In her case, she had a restraining order against her ex-husband, who ended up abducting her daughters, and she repeatedly called the cops and asked them for assistance. They didn't really do anything, and her ex-husband, well, committed a murder-suicide of her daughters, well, and himself, And so she tried to sue these police officers for failing to defend her. But the Supreme Court ruled that in this sense, police officers have an immunity from civil law, just like prosecutors in many jurisdictions have absolute immunity, where no matter how egregious their misconduct, they can't have civil suits filed against them. And for law enforcement, in a lot of cases, they'll have, well, qualified immunity, where in practice is largely absolute immunity, where even if they injure someone unjustifiably in their duties, they're rarely held accountable for that. So, yeah, it is the case that you don't have a constitutional right to police protection. And so this is why I find it important for communities and individuals to not let the police or some third party take care of these functions for them. Like Jackson said, to find some way that people with a ties to the community who have an incentive to make sure that this community is safe because they have a personal stake in it, to find ways to keep it safe instead of relying on the police.
Yeah, I think that's a good point that I think the only real solution to this problem is for the communities to take back that control and the responsibility for themselves. And even beyond just as a community, but on an individual level, that we all need to remember that it's easy to feel safe and then let someone else handle that for us, but it is our personal responsibilities to make sure to keep ourselves and our families and our communities safe.
That's true. And that could take, I think it's worth pointing out, that how we do that could take any number of forms. I mean, we might still want to have formal police, but with some restrictions. Maybe you might want a restriction that any officer must live in the area that he polices, so that they're his friends, his neighbors, and his own house. So maybe there's not so much of a disconnect there. Maybe we can bring back a sense of community to that profession. Now, I think that's kind of hard. It might be hard in big cities with very large bureaucratic police departments, but certainly it seems plausible in smaller communities, and it could take even more decentralized forms and ultimately down to personal responsibility.
So long term, what do you guys see as the results of this kind of militarization? Is it going to continue? Is there going to be some kind of crisis? What do you predict? Will it stop when the money stops flowing from DC?
Well, I definitely think that there's going to be a continued alienation between people and the federal government. Perhaps even more so for people who live in the West. We can see this through things like the Clive and Bundy episode, where people almost see the federal government as kind of an occupying force that just doesn't know how the way of life is in the West. So long term, what will this result? I really have no idea, but I think people feeling like the federal government, and especially the armed agents of it, seeing them as having less legitimacy than they might previously have done.
Let me first say, I think that's right, Tate. And I think the illustrations you point to are right on, but I guess I'll add, I'll try to be a little less pessimistic than Plato, who thought that all democracies would inevitably deteriorate into tyranny. And that might be true for the city states he was dealing with, but for a large centralized situation we find ourselves in America, there's of course another possibility, and that's radical decentralization. So as far as whether we can achieve that or not, that I think is up to the people across the tens of thousands of communities on the continent. And I hope that some will choose more independent path. Those who just want to rely on bailouts, it's not sustainable. It can't last. So that's my hope anyway, is for more decentralization. But I think until that time comes, unfortunately, I see the trend toward militarization because of the incentives in place that we kind of talked about continuing in the near future.
Thank you for listening to the New Polis Podcast. You can visit us at thenewpolis.com.